Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With a New York pen mightier than any sword, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Jimmy Breslin has been waging war against injustice for more than 40 years. He's a writer and a man who calls life like he sees it. Whether it's the Vietnam War or political corruption or the child sex scandal in the Catholic Church, now Jimmy Breslin sees the face of his beloved New York changing and says it's time for the world to figure it out. New York isn't white anymore. It's majority brown, black, and tan. But it's values and America's, he says, have not kept up with its color change. In his new book, The Short, Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez, Breslin tells a heart-wrenching tale of two cities, a small village in Mexico and his own New York City. A 21-year-old Mexican immigrant comes to find the American dream and instead is returned home to his parents in a body bag. This is one story of love and loss set against another of corruption, bad politics, and indifference to people whose lives are perceived not to count. In a country that still depends on cheap labor, how do we value the life of a Mexican man or woman today? Jimmy Breslin makes every child or grandchild of immigrants remember what it's like to be low man or woman on the totem pole. If non-whites are the majority in many cities, how much longer can they be marginalized? We're talking tonight with Mr. New York, Jimmy Breslin. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is Jimmy Breslin. Good evening and welcome, Jimmy Breslin.
Hi.
Good. We're good.
What's up?
Oh, it's all up tonight, and we're glad to have you with us. Jimmy Breslin, also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, is our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Good evening, and welcome, Jack.
Good evening, and good evening to Mr. Breslin. And Mr. Breslin, let me just say that 30 years ago, when I was driving a Boston cab and lucky to earn $20 in a day, you put a $5 bill in my hand. I'm still grateful.
Did I?
You sure did.
I didn't have it in those days up there either.
It must have been a good day for Jimmy Breslin.
That must have been something.
Jimmy, we're awfully happy to have you on the show. And, you know, I wish you'd start out just by giving us the thumbnail sketch of what this book is about and then jump right in and read us something.
I grew up with one novel as the main book of my life, and everybody I knew thought the same. It was called Christ in Concrete by Pietro Di Donato. It was about an Italian immigrant who came here and the building collapsed he was working on, and he drowned in concrete. He had been making no money, working long hours for a bad construction job. The two kids went to the police station at the end of the first chapter, and they asked the desk sergeant for if there's a Bishalia here, that their mother had asked them to go and look because the father had not come home from this construction accident for 2 days. Hmm. So the desk sergeant looks to the right and calls to a guy, we got a Bishalia in here? And the guy said, yeah, that's the WAP under the tarpaulin out in the courtyard.
Yep.
And the two kids heard it. That's how it started, a literary sensation. Di Donato went out to California. He saw 1,500 starlets, as he recalls, and that was the end of his career. He went insane. The young women drove him nuts. They killed him, literally freaking killed him.
What a way to go. But he left a book that got you started, Jimmy Breslin.
He left a book that people talk about and they still reprint it. So it'll be around.
Well, you picked up on that in a pretty literal way.
I'm standing in the newspaper office where I work in the afternoon, a November afternoon, and they tell me that a Mexican immigrant just drowned in concrete in Brooklyn.
And it all came back.
That's my song. And I went right over there and saw the police couldn't pull them out of the concrete. You just can't. They get stuck in there. It's all over.
Yeah.
You can't move them. They weigh 1,000 pounds. So I went with the body to Mexico to the funeral, and then I came back here and how these people got here, the various towns they sidle by and come into the United States. Dangerous lives on railroad tracks in the night.
It's an incredible story, and you tell it with so much empathy. Jimmy Breslin, read us something from early on in the book when they're still in Mexico.
Yeah, he's still in Mexico, this young man, and there's a young woman on the street, very young. She's 16 at the time. Mm. He's 21, and he's painfully shy. He could never talk to her. He just would look at her.
But he was looking at her plenty.
Yes, he was looking at it. He thought it was his life. So the girl's name was Sylvia, and she told Rafael, who was the messenger of romance. He went between Sylvia and Eduardo with messages. She said that she was going to America on Sunday. This was on a Friday night. When Eduardo didn't come into the store, no, this was a Thursday night. When Eduardo didn't come into the store that night, she shrugged as if to shuck off Eduardo. Then she and her sister Amelia talked about a farewell outing on Saturday night at a dance concert in the stadium in Puebla. Sylvia's favorite group, Brindis, was appearing. On Friday night, they were talking about this again when Eduardo walked in with his cousins. Hearing the talk about the concert, he said to Amelia, "Can I come with you?" Amelia said to him, "Okay, you go with her," meaning Sylvia. He never would have had the guts to speak to Sylvia. She never expected Eduardo on Saturday night. Her sister Amelia had set 8:30 as the time they all were to leave for the dance. And when the time came around and Eduardo was not there, she got ready to go with her sister. She didn't know that Eduardo had been outside for a half hour walking up the block, talking to people, then coming back nervously. Finally, he was about to knock on the door just as it opened and the sisters bumped into him coming out. "It is a good idea that you don't go to the dance alone," Sylvia's father called out. Sylvia remembers that she and Eduardo stood in the doorway with her father, and she and Eduardo were a sentence away from being officially together. He had to talk to her to say, "I'm going to take you out," and she would have to say, "Then we're going out," to make it that they're officially dating. She remembers that she and Eduardo stood in the doorway with her father, and they were the sentence away. Eduardo did not say the sentence, but it was obvious that he had nothing else on his mind. Sylvia wore a tiny black blouse, a white jacket over it, and white pants. She still can see Eduardo in black pants, a white pullover sweater, and his favorite black baseball cap. The music the group played was slow and the lyrics romantic, and she was surprised and elated when Eduardo, with no shyness, held her close to him as they danced. She remembers pouring her body over his. "Are you happy that I'm dancing with you?" he asked her. "Yes," she murmured. "I am happy," he said. Some numbers later, still dancing close, he announced with passion, "I am happy I am dancing with you, and I am too." She was sure that the next thing would be a proposal, at least to be his girlfriend. Instead, he fell silent. He held her tight and said nothing. The last dance was at 2 a.m. There was a large crowd and only one exit gate, and it took a long time to get through it. Sylvia's sister and her boyfriend and Eduardo and Sylvia were up against each other in the big crowd, and now Sylvia felt that this would do it. You could see that he was thrilled to be so close to her, as was she. They got out of the park and into a cab. She sat and waited for him to suggest a stop. He did not. The cab went up to her house next to her house, which was right next to the store where she worked. Her sister and her boyfriend got out. Sylvia did not move. Of course he was going to kiss her. When he did not move for many moments, she got out of the cab. He waved to her as the cab pulled away. The next morning, Sunday, she stood on the street for a moment. "What are you doing there?" her mother said. "Your uncle won't be here for a half hour. The uncle was taking her to America." "I know," she said. She waited in that dusty street, and when Eduardo did not come up to it, she was about to break all the rules of her life and go down to the brickyard where Eduardo worked, and maybe the moment he saw her, he would come out and told her the way he had when they had danced the night before, and he would tell her that he wanted her to be his girlfriend, and then she would say to our uncle, "No, you go. I am staying here because I love Eduardo." "Are you ready?" she remembers hearing her uncle say. This was on the morning of May 8, 1998.
Jimmy Breslin reading from his new book, The Short Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez. Jimmy Breslin, you dove into Mexico like nobody's business to dredge up the detail for this story. And it's there, and it's so human, and you take it from that moment right across the Rio Grande. Not just once, but a lot of family members coming over, and it all ends up in New York. That for all the poverty of the Mexican village that you track down, the New York looks like a pretty banged up place itself. When you look at the morality of the people that receive these Mexican immigrants,
he came to New York and moved into one room in Brighton Beach, a large second floor room that had 10 people sleeping on the floor, no beds, no pillows, just 10 on the floor. And they got up early in the morning and went to work. He was there, and he got a job, the construction job. And the construction job consisted of low money, $6 an hour, $6.50 an hour, long hours, 12 hours, no days off, no medical coverage if anything happens, and just work with bad equipment and shaky building. And they worked, and they had nothing else. You get up in the morning. Well, you get up in the morning, there's 10 people in the room with you. Now, they've got to use the bathroom. There's one bathroom. And it took 10 minutes apiece. They figured that out. So anybody, if you stayed there 10 minutes and 30 seconds, they banged on the door. But this is from 5:30 in the morning on. The people, these young men are using the bathroom, getting ready and going to work. And if you were slow or you weren't with it and you were the last, it would take you an hour and a half of sitting around waiting.
Jimmy Breslin, did you expect to get this captured by the story of these Mexican immigrants? Had you always related to this community? Had you paid attention to this community?
No. I mean, but they're the exact same as somebody from the Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico, the poor. Or the blacks that came up from the South. It's all the same. You don't have. And they always say, well, we'll have to have a survey. What's wrong with the Mexican community? What bothers them? What bothers them is they're broke. That's what bothers them.
They're broke and they're working hard. You say that when they stand out by the street waiting for that job, the word job throbs through their bodies unconditionally. And then you point out the real moral temptation here. You say for all the valor spent chasing work, the Mexicans also are irresistible temptations, the nearest occasion of mortal sin, cheap labor. It is blood in the mouth of nearly everybody who hires. Jack Beatty, do you hear it? Jimmy Breslin is latching on here, or telling the story of the new bottom of the totem pole.
Oh, yeah,
he
they're
is.
The bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. And there's such a supply of them, as you say, 100 million people down there. And we've got a kind of official hypocrisy about these people, don't we, Jimmy? I mean, on the one hand, we deplore that they're here. On the other hand, and they'll be harassed and sent back. On the other hand, much of the economy wouldn't work without them.
Jimmy Breslin.
Cheap labor. What more do you want?
Yeah,
They don't let us have slavery anymore.
This is the,
so the next
this
best
is the
thing to slavery. After, if you can't have slavery, you can have cheap labor, which is
of course, as you point out, it isn't cheap to them. It's $20 a week in the brickyard back in for a 70-hour week back in Mexico. And Sylvia was earning $420 a week at College Station, Texas, working a couple of restaurants.
She went and got she worked 16 hours, 17 hours a day for the money, 6 days a week. Nobody has any time to themselves, but it's a fortune of money to people coming up from up there.
What did the family say when you showed up in Mexico, Jimmy Breslin? What did they make of you when their son was home dead?
Well, they thought they were very gracious. They thought it was very nice of me to come. They're very civilized people, and they break your heart. They're simple, and they appreciate the slightest thing, if you smiled or if you just said hello, gave your condolences to the mother, they were enthralled. They thought it was great. They liked it. They're very open people. I didn't have a moment's trouble in the whole thing. The only thing I had was my background. I didn't learn Spanish in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I never learned it anywhere. I took a year of Spanish, and I'm terrible. So I had two interpreters. Wilda Cordero, who was worked for the lawyer, and Maurice Pinzon, who had been in politics, and he's from Colombia, the state of country of Colombia. Mm-hmm. But they'd start talking. Now, well, Wilder would start talking to Sylvia in the dining room of a motel in Austin, Texas, and they talked.
They sure did. We hear that. Jimmy, we got to take a short break. We want to come back and hear exactly what you heard. We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Jimmy Breslin. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Jimmy Breslin, Mr. New York. He's got a new book out. It's called The Short, Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez. And it's about the tragic story that starts in a small Mexico hamlet and ends up with a young Mexican man dying in a pool of cement in New York. And he's really raising the moral questions for all Americans, not just New Yorkers, about our view of the cheap labor that swims among us that's not white, that's exploited. Does Jimmy Breslin sway your view of Mexican immigrants? Are we all culpable in the exploitation of cheap immigrant labor? Jimmy Breslin, the family, you were just describing how you went down. You talked with them in Texas. Mm-hmm. You talked with them in Mexico. They clearly poured out their hearts. You've got incredible detail here about this tender love that got going, about their longing to be in America, to make something happen for their families in Mexico. Where did you sit and hear these stories?
Well, with Sylvia, with the young woman, I sat at a table in a motel in College Station, Texas. And Imelda Cordero, this was one of three or four times we saw her. And Imelda Cordero, the interpreter, talked to her.
You'd make anybody fall in love with her. What was her attitude when she talked to you?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Very nice.
She seemed, in your book, she just comes alive as a young woman you want to know.
She's a live woman. But in talking to her, Wilder would get so wrapped up talking to her, she'd forget to talk to me. I'd say, "Are you supposed to tell me what you're talking about?" And I could see the two of them were irritated that this fat slob was butting into their conversation. that was the only problem with the translating, because I had to have the nuances of the way they spoke in that town.
Jimmy,
you know, and that had to be careful when
right.
She was taking it, getting it down.
You told us how Christ in Concrete, the earlier book, sort of set you up with a template. You knew this story, but is there something different about the way Americans are receiving and treating this wave of poor immigrants?
Why is it different?
I don't know. You tell me. Is it?
They look to rob them. They look to use them, and they despise them. So I think so far that's 3 for 3. I don't see any differences past that.
The same Mexicans, as the Irish story, the same as the Italian?
No, the Mexicans are darker. Mm. Latitude rules all things. Mm. The closer you are to the equator, the darker you get. So they're dusky, running, some of them are running to very dark. And the Irish came here pale or freckled, and they didn't offend you as much. But the Mexicans do, because they're dark. But beyond that, nothing.
You say it's a tiny drop of pigment that makes that difference in color, and yet it makes all the difference in the world, you say.
It's under the pigment in your skin, in your body, the melanin, what do they call it, melanin, it's under our ability to weigh. It's so tiny. And that's what, over the tens of thousands of years, turns you black, if you're from the Congo, turns you dusky if you're from Mexico, and that's how that is. The big thing is it protects you from skin cancer, and it's very important that your skin be dark in that hot sun. So they were born with dark skin and black skin in order to be saved from being white.
But it doesn't protect anybody from the labor setup in New York City. Jimmy Breslin, describe the sort of racket that these workers were funneling into in the late 90s. Rudy Giuliani was mayor, and describe the whole system that you tell us that they came into, where they were exploited.
Well, Giuliani wanted to be president, governor, mayor, anything, senator, so they needed a lot of money. The Hasidic set in Williamsburg in Brooklyn was a great group to give money to a politician's campaign.
Why?
A lot of money.
Why?
I mean, big money. Well, because they understand America better than anybody. Maybe they have beards and black hats and payas, and they speak with a Eastern European in their voice, but they understand the politics of the city. You pay, and you're in. If you don't pay, you're out, period. So they would give big money to campaigns. I mean, like the Satmars would give $85,000, $100,000 more.
What did they get for it?
Now, here's what you got. They never went there before the election and asked for things. Never. The minute Giuliani was elected, they would show up in City Hall and just walk in and say what they wanted. All Giuliani knew was that he won because of them. So he didn't refuse them. He wasn't making any false promises. He was giving. Now, what they gave is if there was an accident on the job, if it was shoddy construction and the building inspectors were bothering the building, he had a man in City Hall named Shira, and they sent him over to Shira to fix the it was Teitelbaum collected the money. He sent Shira over there to fix it. If the building inspectors were there, they were told to get lost.
So forget the labor rules. Forget the building inspector's role.
Nothing. Just don't bother this job. This man, Oestreicher, is our friend. And that was it. There was no union. No union job. No building inspections of any sort. They would attempt to have one, and the papers on it just would get disregarded. Nobody cared.
And what did it finally mean for Eduardo Gutierrez? Give us that last 5 minutes of his life in America.
Yeah. The last 5 minutes of his life in America is he's working on the building, a three-story condominiums they were building for faculty for yeshiva schools that were around that part of Brooklyn, parochial schools. And they were building it with shoddy building. They were around the corner. The same builder had been building the same type of buildings, and he had a couple of collapses. The fire department came. The chief, Blaich, wanted the city to ensure that this guy does not work again, does not build again in this city. He's a dangerous man. It must be stopped. And they didn't. What they did was they took the buildings inspector, building supervisor for the borough of Brooklyn, and replaced them, get rid of them. And that took care of all complaints. So that was his life. Eduardo's was to work, get as much money as he could out of save as much, and send it home. And then come back and just to live the week out with small change. And when the next money came in, send it. There was no big checks coming in, no one-month lump. He got paid every week. You had to fight for your money sometimes. The guy would send somebody to pay off, and it would be always a little short. Then you had to wait for the next week. They took any advantage they could take of a working man, they did.
And at the end, you say the third floor fell into the second floor, and the second floor fell into the first.
That's how it went, yep. He got up in the morning, and he started to go in the bathroom, and they all were running past him, and he wound up being the last going in, and his friend Alejandro looked at him and said, "Your timing is off." Then they took the subway to work and came down the street to the bodega, which is next door to their job. He had a cup of coffee, a piece of toast, and he sat at a table that was next to between shelves of peppers, sugar, onions, Mr. Clean, Tampax, Pampers, Ziploc bags, and racks of pornographic books. Now, outside on the street, a large, speedy pumping truck was there with a big revolving barrel. It's a concrete truck that sends concrete climbing up through a hose to the third floor, where it comes out in a big metal spout, sends it all over the floor, and they smooth it out. Eduardo had a large machine that looked like a floor waxer, and he would be doing that, and it made a lot of noise, and the truck downstairs made a lot of noise, and they couldn't hear anything. And the fellow on the corner of the floor, they're up on the third floor with all this wet concrete, and the fellow on the Sanchez in the corner looked at light coming through the side of the wall that was supposed to be fastened to the building, to the wall, and up to the roof, the rear wall and up to the roof. Yeah. Fingers of light were showing. And they're showing more. And he looked and he got very frightened and he yelled out, "No bueno." Well, it was too late. without a sound. There's no swaying or quivering, no time even for a warning gasp from somebody. 1 second to the other, Alejandro says. An instant, a shrug of commerce, a shrug of concrete and metal, and the floor under Eduardo gave. Down Eduardo went so quickly that he made no sound. The third floor fell into the second floor, and the second fell into the first floor, and everything fell into the basement. The rear wall blew, so did a wall that was supposed to be tied to the building. There was a cascade of bricks and cinder blocks and metal. What was supposed to be metal beams holding up the floors were as strong as aluminum foil. Eduardo fell face first into 3 feet of concrete on the basement floor and drowned.
Jimmy Breslin describing the last few minutes of the life of a man whose life in Mexico and America he has brought into a beautiful book, The Short Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez. Jack Beatty, you've read this. This is in a long tradition of American writing about the bottom of the barrel.
It really is. I mean, Jacob Riss was writing stuff like this through How the Other Half Lives.
He couldn't write as good as I do.
Well, of course.
That's right. No.
Let's put it where it's at.
He didn't have Breslin's touch. But you know,
sit
you're
here very quietly. And then I explode.
But you know, you're so good here on the politics of this. This is the way cities work. Contractors give contributions; they get favors in return.
Sure.
What struck me at the end of the book, the contractor who did this and who the city, the fire people had wanted, the firemen wanted to put out of business. He's only got by OSHA, by the federal government. Yep. It wasn't even the city. It took someone from outside to say, "Hey, wait a minute, we've got." And he didn't have to do any jail time either. It seems.
Jack Beatty, Jimmy Breslin, stand by. I want to bring some callers in here. They want to join us. They want to come right in. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that it's very interesting that this is going on now, but this has been going on historically for a long time. I'm an immigrant myself. My parents came to this country 52 years ago, and my father was injured many times working as almost a slave laborer, similar to what Jimmy is describing in his book. Very interesting parallels.
Yeah, it is history repeating itself. But Jimmy Breslin, you say it's not entirely the same this time. How is this lower latitude population that you described, the brown population, going to make its way up the American ladder? And Mike, thanks for your call. Jimmy.
I don't know. There's one dramatic flaw in their reasoning, as they're here, is that they don't want to learn English because they're going to go home. They're only going to be here enough time to get money to build a house in Mexico when they're going home. Well, that's fanciful. It doesn't happen. They're here for good, and they just don't pick up the English, as they're going to have to. There's got to be, you've got to be just very firm with them. You can't take it anymore. You can't just walk around this town and not know a word of English.
You're going to be exploited if you do. Stephen is on the line. Welcome, Stephen. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
I want to draw a parallel between what you're talking about in New York and probably around the country and all-inclusive resorts. I've been to a few of them, and every time I go, I wonder to myself, am I exploiting the local laborers who provide cheap gardening services and other...
You mean like a tourist resort in Mexico or the Caribbean, that kind of thing, Stephen?
Absolutely, and I've been to one in the Caribbean, I've been to one in Mexico. Or am I helping to prop up the local economy by bringing my dollars to this poor section of whatever country or island?
Jimmy, Stephen, thanks for the question. Jimmy Breslin, how about it? You've described what goes on in New York. Do you feel guilty now when you get on a cruise ship in the Caribbean or go for some sunshine in the Dominican Republic?
I haven't been on a cruise ship in a long time. I wish I was going to be on one tomorrow morning. That takes care of my role in that matter. I'll write about them. I'll pour my heart out. I did this book without any view of finances at all. We just took the first low offer. Take it. I want to write this book. Nobody's going to pay a fortune for a dead Mexican. And I wrote it. Now, where do I stand at the end of it? If there's some marvelous club, it's got 3-4 help going there. Well, I can guarantee you the help they'll get tipped good, but I'm going to be there. I don't know what else you can do.
And how about...
What if I don't go, what am I doing? What's going on? I don't go to them anyway. My daughter went to one. And she said that there was so much help that she was enthralled and nearly threw up and wanted to come home.
Yeah.
It's tough to take.
And Jimmy,
well, if you go, I can vouch for the tip.
Yeah, there you go. I'm not cheap.
Just got the tip ready. But Jimmy Breslin, what about Americans when they're right here at home? Do you see people who don't even think about it as unwitting supporters of the system that brought Eduardo Gutierrez to his death?
Well, of course they don't think about it. Why would you want to think about a Mexican? No, forget them. I got my own life to worry about. That would be the way people think, huh? Oh, it's nice that the heartrending story you told was very good, a lovely story. Oh, I feel for those people. Thank you, good night, you know. No.
That's it.
No. Well, what else do you want from them?
You tell me.
The conditions wouldn't be what they are if people cared. They don't care.
Let's take a call. No. Virad is on the line. Welcome, Virad. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. I wanted to ask if in the previous story, the first story that happened in New York, was it 40, 30 years ago? Was there also a Jewish theme there to the villains?
You mean Christ in Concrete?
Yeah. No, being the exploiting the workers, paying off the politicians.
No, I don't think so, because at that time the villains were Irish.
Mm-hmm.
They brought them in. In fact, it was building the Brooklyn Bridge. It was an Irish contractor, and he found a way he had Irish working there, and then they found a way you could bring in Italians from Sicily for $1 a day less. He fired all the Irish and put the Italians to work.
Virad, why do you ask?
I don't think the Jews were up to a point where they could even think of exploiting somebody. Uh-huh. They were getting so robbed themselves.
I thought about the question only because I thought, as you were telling this story, I heard the sort of anti-Semitic overtones. And
where?
The way you described it, but I take it it's not that. It sort of bothered me there for a little bit.
What? Come on. No.
All right.
No. Not even there. That's the last thing. That's the last thing anybody thought of.
It's
your paranoia. I understand, and I'm with you, beautiful. But it didn't fit here.
Okay, great. I would look forward to reading.
I did put in on one of the streets in Williamsburg where they were building. Right next door was a school that had been a grammar school, a yeshiva, and the three or four guys from the New City. They were headquartered in New City, a Hasidic sect, came up with a plan to make a college out of it, and they got $40 million from the federal government. And Hillary Clinton came in and had to bail them out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
I did put that in. I thought it was hilarious. They didn't have any students, but they got the money.
Virad, thank you for a call. It looks like Jimmy is just telling it like he sees it there. We're talking with Jimmy Breslin. He's got a new book out, The Short, Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez, looking at the life of Mexican immigrants in the United States. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you want to hear from Jimmy Breslin? We'll be right back. We're going to spread our conversation out a little bit. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. .org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Jimmy Breslin. He's got a new book out looking at the plight of Mexican immigrant workers in the United States. But while we've got him, we're going to talk about just anything you want to talk about. What do you want to hear from Jimmy Breslin? What's your question for Mr. New York? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jimmy Breslin, we're not shying away from your topic tonight, but while we've got you, we don't get you off, and we want to hear what else is on your mind. What do you think of George W. Bush? How's he doing?
Let's talk about me.
Sure.
How's that?
What's
That's
up with you, Jimmy?
Topic. Okay. Nothing. So we're in trouble. I don't know what Bush is doing. Let's see how this works out with the Middle East. If you can't figure some way out of this, we're in a lot of trouble.
Do you like his war on terror?
I don't think they're doing anything. I don't think they know whoever's coming from. I mean, we got hit at the World Trade Center. We had the CIA. We had the FBI. We had all these government agencies Army intelligence, Navy intelligence, supposed to be all over the world telling us what's going on. They didn't know anything. The famed Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, mm-hmm. supposed to know everything. They didn't tell us it was coming. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't know anything. They're all frauds. They're all on payroll. The whole security system is crazy. I wouldn't pay one of them. They don't do anything, and they can't do anything.
Why not?
Because they're incapable. They don't know what's happening. They can't speak the languages that we're dealing with in this world. Here's a woman in my building who was born in Persia, speaks Farsi all her life. Up came this ad the FBI put out. They needed people that could speak that language desperately. So she went down and applied. Good. 3 months later, they got to her. And then they said they want to give her a test, an eight-hour test to show she can do the language. I told her, don't go. Tell the guy that you want to test what they know. Never mind what you know.
Jimmy, how's your city doing? How's New York?
It's doing the same as it always did. It's 8 million people. It's a great big city. It's the same as it always was. The only difference is we got hit with a major attack that nobody had ever seen before. But it didn't make any difference in the daily life of the city. In fact, it showed one thing about New York when it did happen. When the buildings went and everybody started running, we're on Liberty Street where I was. Everybody ran to get away from this debris coming down. It was horrid. But now they got up onto the main avenues leading uptown and across the bridge to Brooklyn, the bridges, and they started to walk. Shirt sleeves because it was a hot day, tens of thousands at first, then hundreds of thousands, and then a couple of million people were on these streets walking, walking, walking. Once in a while they'd stop and look back at the smoke and know there was nothing inside that smoke anymore, that it was gone, and then they'd walk. If they bumped into each other, somebody would say, excuse me. That's the one word that New York has used most over the years. Excuse me, pardon me. We've used that more than the entire earth uses it. This is the most civilized city on earth. Now, these people were walking, and as they walked quietly, without much noise, a little bumping, nothing else, no panic. My God, no. They walked without a policeman, without a fireman directing them, without a traffic director, without a politician, with nobody. They just walked and they went home.
Jack Beatty.
There never has been a sight like it. If you had a NASCAR crowd in that place, they would have panicked. They're not. Nobody is used to living in tight quarters and getting the business done. And if it's a panic, they just they act it. There's never been a sight like it. Unfortunately, nobody took many pictures of it because they're all stuck down at the devastation. There was no television, and there was no cameras. You had to be in it to realize it. Yeah.
It sounds like Jimmy Breslin is not prepared to concede that even 9/11 could shake up New Yorkers.
It didn't. A couple of days.
Yeah.
A little while. That's all. The rest of the country, it's beyond belief. Beyond belief. If a politician is opening a new beauty shop in a mall in Iowa, in Cedar City, Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He comes there with the scissor to cut the ribbon, but first he says, could we all have a moment of silence for 9/11? They love that 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
So they all have a moment of silence. Tears roll down his cheeks, and he shows that he's patriotic and loyal and a great political leader. And then he cuts the ribbon to the beauty shop. And that's all over the country. If somebody's restaurant is slow in business, it's because 9/11. The guy's in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's worried about it. San Diego. That's the real. And they're putting in for things I thought I could put in and get the copyright, the patent on 9/11.
Forget
stop
about it.
Them from doing it. Well, I'm about 1,000th in line, and what do they got? Speedy Lorenzo's Pizza Shop 9/11. They put in for the name. They want a chain of them. Every place you look, they're turning in. They want to get patents on that so they can have that on their name. 9/11 clothes. Everybody wants that. We had to get bombed and blown up, and they go around and try and steal the title.
Jack, get in here with me. Jimmy Breslin is going off on 9/11. He's had enough of it.
What about the man it made king, Giuliani? He became a hero after that. What do you think about that?
On the 10th of September, he had a famous bunker where he was going to go. He had told everybody, if anything ever happened wrong in New York because of my foresight, I have had this bunker built, and your city government will be safe and protected and functioning. It had diesel fuel somehow to keep it moving. Well, the plane hit the building, and the building hit the building Giuliani's bunker was in, and here went the bunker into the air, and the diesel oil came all over the building and knocked that building out. 7 World Trade Center was gone.
But he's Giuliani, a hero. He's a national hero now.
He went out in the street. He didn't know where he was. He staggered around, and then he saw a television camera. So they put him on the camera. He didn't fold. He stood straight and talked. He came on 5 minutes later, 10 minutes after that. He came on 1,500 times on television, and everybody thought he was holding the city together. He was standing in front of a camera, did nothing, didn't lift one shovel
full
of dirt.
You're tough, Jimmy. Jimmy, let's get one more caller in here. Martin's calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Martin. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Jimmy.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering, you ever find it necessary to have to hire a bodyguard to protect
you? No, that's gone.
No?
Who cares? No, who would want? No. No.
Why do you ask, Martin?
Well, because of the things he exposes are so criminal, and, you know, there are victims, as he was speaking about earlier. You would think that other people would be involved in such things other than you, the writer.
We got it, Martin. Thanks for the call. Does somebody want a piece of you, Jimmy?
No, I went to a dinner at Buffalo, a famous dinner up there. Rocky Graziano was there, and he was the late Rocky Graziano, and he's saying, I came here for a sports dinner. He came up there, and he said, I'm here because my friend Joe told me to come. And if Joe Lewis was sitting in the audience. And if Joe tells me to come, I come. Don't worry about that. Say hello. Joe DiCarlo, stand up. He was a big mob guy. That was Buffalo. He was the star of the dinner.
Jimmy Breslin, look out at the big world for us. The U.S. is standing very tall in the language it's using these days. It's flying its military around. It's showing the flag. It's showing the bombs. How do you think it's working? Is it the right response to the hit we took?
Oh, I don't know. That's the trouble that kills you. How do you respond to what that guy got away with? You see what you're up against. We put up a $25 million reward for his head, right?
Where's the head?
Has anybody for Bin Laden?
Where is it? Right.
Has anybody over there grabbed the money? Come forward to claim the money? No, they don't come for two reasons. One, they know they'll get killed. That's a pretty good reason. But second, they believe in the guy. So what are we going to do if we can't bribe our way out of this? I don't know what we're going to do. That's the great American tactic. We're brilliant at that, bribing. We can do anything. We could bribe any place, but we don't have a chance here. $25 million is a lot of money. I'd turn you in for that amount of money.
But it goes to your book at that level. We have all this money. We have all this wealth, and the world is looking at it. Are we doomed then to get hit this way?
Well, they're not going to bother poor people much, huh? Who else would you go after? This is the place. This is the target. And I think these big corporations we have been meddling in the businesses around the world, meddling in the countries where they have business, robbing the people as best they can, jerking them around, bribing the politicians to get what they want, the same as they do in Brooklyn. There's no difference. We have one style in America, and that's sometimes we have to bomb them out, but it's much better to bribe, pay them out. That's
Jimmy,
the American form.
I hate to say it, but we're out of time. It was great of you to join us tonight. Thank you so much, Jimmy Breslin.
It was very good,
Jimmy,
to be here. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Jimmy Breslin.
Where are you, Petey? Where are you?
Up in Vermont.
Up in the mountains.
And you're at the Atlantic Monthly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's our Jack. Another fiver waiting for you, Jack Beatty. Jimmy Breslin's new book is The Short Sweet Dream of Eduardo Gutierrez. Jimmy Breslin, thanks for being with us tonight. Jack Beatty, just a word before we go.
Oh, I can't say a thing. what a great pleasure to have you on, Jimmy Breslin.
Yeah, here's here to that. You can read Jimmy Breslin's recent columns, though, on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. In a moment, a radio diary on being unemployed in an economy on the upswing. This is On Point. most indicators pointing to an economic recovery, financial forecasters have been optimistic about the nation's economic health. But Frank Shute sees it differently. He worked for Polaroid for more than 30 years. But when the Massachusetts-based company went bankrupt last fall, he was out of a job. His wife still works there, but there's little job security these days at the company for her either. Frank's been collecting unemployment and searching for a decent job. In this diary, he says that it's hard to recognize economic recovery when you can't find work.
Polaroid was an institution. I mean, it was there forever, and it held on to its people. It was good to its people, and you never expected that to happen. You never expected it to go bankrupt, and it sure did. The unemployment's going to end. They signed a 13-week extension. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get that. I'm going to have to look for a job. I have been looking for a job, but there aren't that many jobs out there. I was basically similar to a farmer. Do I be able to do something like that? I don't think I'm going to find a job like that. I'm not going to find a job making the money I made at Polaroid. When I hear about the economy being up, it's always up and it's always doing well when you've got a job and you're making a lot of money. But if you're not working, the economy can be wherever it is. It doesn't matter whether it's down or whether it's up. I'm not so sure I see that many more jobs around. They say that, and I've been looking in the paper, and I don't see any more jobs than there were before, unless you want to bag groceries at, you know, the local Stop and Shop or whatever. If you're going to work 40 hours a week and you're going to take home $200 a week or $250 or something like that and try to support a family, it's not going to happen. So if you want to call that a job, fine, there's jobs, but there aren't any decent jobs where you're making enough money to support a family, to have medical benefits, and maybe either save a little money or whatever, at least pay for a home or pay for an apartment. I don't see those kind of jobs out there. I'm skeptical of the government. I think they tell you what you want to hear. I only believe it when I see the numbers. You know, show me the numbers. You give me that, then I'll know what, you know, whether things are well or not. You know, if I see a lot of people working, I see a lot of people not working. I have a brother-in-law who's got 12,000 degrees who's not working. I got another one who's got them, and this company's getting ready to fold. So I don't see that as economic recovery. When they're all working again, making money, then I'll say we're doing well. When we get there, we get there, but I don't see it yet. The things that concern me as I get older, and I think a lot of people, is I've put in Social Security since I was probably 13, I think. And you say, well, it's always going to be there. Now you look and you say, well, that's in trouble. And I worked at Polaroid for almost 36 years, and that was always going to be there, and that's gone. And I've still got my pension. I don't think they can touch that, but we never know. There's going to come a time, you know, I'm not going to be able to work, and I'm going to be home. And I want to make sure that those things are there. I mean, these are things that we thought would be there. Now, I've never not realized how lucky I've been by working at Polaroid all the years I have to have the things that I do have. I could have a lot more, and I definitely could have a lot less. I just hope that by the time I stop working, that I'm going to have enough money that I can live comfortably and not end up in a breadline. For the average person, and I consider myself maybe average, I don't know. You want to make sure that you're all set, you know, that there's going to be a stream of money to at least keep you being able to sit in front of the fireplace or the TV until, you know, the time comes that you go up to wherever you go, you know.
Frank Shute lives in Salem, Massachusetts. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Tell us how the events in the news are affecting your life. If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from WBUR Boston.
This is W.